Welcome to Leader Insider Secrets, where we get to the source of success. Hear from leaders who bear all and share their insider secrets, along with my episodes aimed at optimizing your performance, productivity, success, and well-being. Hi, my name's Estelle Reed at B.Company, and I'm an executive coach, trainer, and author of Inner Brilliance, Outer Shine, which explores 10 antidotes to imposter syndrome, workaholism, and stress. Okay, let's begin.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I've got Ros Watkins with me, who is the author of the acclaimed D.I. Meg Dalton crime series, which is set in the Peak District. The first series, The Devil's Dice, was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger Award, which is so flipping fantastic. I felt so proud for you. And was the Times, listen to this, folks, the Times Crime Book of the Month. Again, really, really cool. Ros originally studied engineering at Cambridge and then worked as a patent attorney for 15 years, which may explain why there's a dead one in a first novel. She's also a qualified hypnotherapist and an animal trainer, giving plenty of scope for planning creative murders. Ros lives in the Peak District with a partner and a menagerie of demanding animals, and likes walking in the hills with a dog, scouting out good places to kill people. So, I love it. Welcome, welcome. And is your boy just sat at your feet right now? Is he still there?
Yeah, so he may start being a demanding animal any minute, but it looks calm at the moment. It's when we get near to his time when he has his F-O-O-D, but we may struggle.
I love it. I love the way we spell with our animals and hope that they...
And then they actually learn to spell, don't they, eventually?
Yeah, no, thank you so much for coming on. I was honoured that Ros actually endorsed my book, Inner Brilliance, Outer Shine, 10 Antidotes to Imposter Syndrome, Workaholism and Stress. I have to keep looking at that title because I keep getting the words mixed up. Which isn't great, is it? But it's going to be published on the 25th of March, 2022. And I thought it'd be really good to interview the people that actually endorse the book. So, and to get a different slant on some exec insider secrets relating to that book. So hence why I've invited Ros along. I've also got a slight confession to make, folks. Ros and I are friends. We trained together, didn't we? How many years ago?
Lots. Is it?
18.
Yeah. Lot. Oh my God, is it?
Yeah, 18. Well, I've been running B 16 years, and it took me a couple of years to get my backside into gear before I even set my business up. So probably longer than that. Shocking, isn't it? Look at us now, middle-aged women. Oh no, thank you so much for coming on. I think this will be brilliant, folks, because typically we have people who come on the show that are still in industry or in the corporate world, but Ros has done both and is obviously an amazing author, with Harper Collins, no less. So people can get to know you, we're going to do a bit of a quick fire round.
Okay.
So the first question is, how long have you been in your current role?
Well, if we count my current role as writing, basically about 5 years. Five, 6 years.
That's gone so quick, hasn't it?
I can't believe. When you ask me, I'm thinking, no, it can't be, but it is.
Yeah. So describe a snapshot of an ordinary day for you as an author. What would you be doing?
So there is a lot of what you'd expect. So I've got my little writing shed here in my garden, which is lovely. So I'm sort of looking out at a field which has got sheep in it and thinking about my book. And sometimes I'm having days where I'm writing quite a lot of words, and other times I'm literally just thinking, trying to work out plots. And yeah, there's a lot of that. Some days it's really frustrating because you don't actually get any words down, or you even go backwards. But other days, you know, you get lots done. And then there's until the last sort of couple of years, there was quite a lot of going to sort of events and, you know, also festivals and doing panels and things. But obviously not recently. I've kind of been locked in my writing shed for the last 18 months.
Because we're in COVID times.
Trying not to go.
I don't know about you. Obviously I've been working at home as well. And I think it's really pushed me to stay at home. And you know, some days my car doesn't go off the drive due to me, and I'm just at home so much.
Quite
comfortable. But so behind us, we can see you've got a whiteboard. I'm dying to know about your ideas. And so
you see, murder board.
Is that your murder board?
It is. It's actually got a massive whiteboard sort of all along the side of this garden room. Sometimes it'll be full of post-it notes for sort of plotting out ideas. At the moment, it's just got a little drawing. So my next book that's out hopefully next year, it's called The Red House, and I can actually see the little red house. So I was just working out the sort of geography of the village where the next book was set. But it's not normally drawings, it's normally more like writing of sort of names and what they're doing and what their kind of backstory is and motivations, secrets, all that sort of thing.
Oh, that's so
helps
good.
To pace up and down the room and sort of write all that stuff on the board.
And did you say you use post-it notes as well?
Yeah, sometimes when I'm plotting the book, I'll put different scenes, because the book's maybe got like 80 or 90 scenes, sort of separate individual scenes, not chapters, but they tend to move around a lot especially when you're planning, which I sort of plan the whole way through. I don't just plan it at the beginning and then write it. Kind of write a bit, plan a bit, so you'll end up with, I might have a certain color of post-it note for the different locations that my character's in. So if my cop is in the police station, I might put the scene on a yellow post-it or something like that. And if she's out, you know, in the wilds, I might put it on the pink one. And then I can see, as it's all laid out, I can kind of see that there's a variety of different locations. And then I can move stuff around sort of as the book changes, which it always does when I'm writing it.
I love that, you know, because, you know, one of my pet peeves is when I watch a movie and it's all set in the same location. I hate that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the sci-fi movies where they're just in a space capsule, I find it really boring.
Go land on a planet or something, for goodness sake. <It's> aliens.
I love it. And I was listening to, I can't remember who it was. I was listening to someone on the radio the other day, very famous writer, I can't remember who it was. But they were saying that sometimes when they're writing, they don't know where the character's going to go or what's going to pop out as you write. Is it like that then?
Definitely. I mean, I know some people do plot quite a detailed sort of outline in advance, but I tend to have a rough idea sort of how it starts, how it finishes maybe, but I find that I don't really know my characters very well when I start writing, and they sort of develop. And sometimes you're writing and you've just almost just sort of comes out of your fingers. Dialogue, especially for me, tends to come fairly naturally. And somebody will just say something that I'm not expecting, and that'll lead them off in a completely different direction. Or you'll get later on in the book and you'll realise that something happened earlier that actually sort of fits in really well, but you didn't consciously know when you put that thing in where you were going, but maybe on some level you did. It's quite odd. It's like flipping between that sort of conscious planning part of your brain and that unconscious letting it flow part of your brain.
Yeah.
It's quite, yeah, quite an interesting sort of balance really between those two.
Yeah, I love it. This is so hilarious, right? We're 10 minutes in already, and this was supposed to be the quick fire round bit. I knew I'd be like this with you. I just find it very interesting. So
we can talk for England. I think the first time we ever met, we were like,
So my next question is going to be, what's on your bedside table? Come on, so
what do you think? A massive pile of books, obviously. And usually a cat as well, trying to steal possibly a coffee mug, which the cat is trying to steal. One of our cats really loves coffee. So knocking the pile of books over, that's the general scenario.
And just one last quick fire question. Do you have a morning ritual or a routine? What's...
I'm usually woken up by cats.
What time do you get up?
Sort of 6-ish usually.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily mean to get up at 6, but I don't let them into the bedroom because they start, they bring dead things in. Yes, we had a rabbit the other day. It's not good. And lots of rats. So yeah, but about 6 they normally start saying that it's time for breakfast, and I try and hold off for a bit, but yeah, I generally give in. And the dogs usually wake, I think the cats wake the dog up basically. So
and do you, what time do you start writing? Do you have a particular time that you start writing, or?
Don't really know. So I think when I was first sort of self-employed, I tended to feel that I had to be kind of working between set hours.
Yeah.
Otherwise I'd feel really guilty.
Yeah.
But now I sort of feel a bit more relaxed and flexible about that.
Yeah.
So it will depend. So most mornings I'll take the dog for a walk. And then while I'm walking, I'm usually quite often either listening to audiobooks or thinking about the book that I'm plotting.
Yeah.
So the dog walk is sort of work in a way.
Yeah.
And I do sometimes like really make myself think about a particular plot issue while I'm walking or doing something in the garden or, you know, something kind of fairly repetitive. And that can work really better than just sort of sitting at my desk trying to thrash it out. But
that's a really efficient way of thinking as well, though. Yeah. And that's a good tip, isn't it? Regardless of whether you're a writer or if you're in the corporate world, you know, to do an activity, a repetitive activity like that to help you to think things through.
There's loads of research, isn't there, on you know, when you're walking, you activate different parts of your brain, and you know, it's a really good way to actually start thinking more creatively.
Yeah,
so that's my excuse anyway for just going on long dog walks when I should be working.
I love it. I do a similar thing actually, and you know, it's interesting you say you set yourself with the task of something to think about, and mine's less glamorous. I do it while I'm putting my makeup on and getting ready. But no, I love that. So I think I might have explained that. So the questions are going to be centered around different chapters in the book, and we're going to move on to chapter 2, which is all to do with captaining your ship. And you and I are very familiar with this concept, aren't we, as coaches or trained coaches, that be in charge of your own destiny, raise awareness of what's happening now, then you can choose to do something different. So from your perspective, how do you know it's time to change? And change could be a limiting belief, it could be a behavior, it could be an emotion. What are your kind of signals?
So usually what gets me now makes me realize I need to sort of get control of things is when I feel myself losing focus and drifting onto things like social media,
yes.
which I think is a massive trap at the moment. And I can almost feel as if my brain has not, but has, you know, become less good in the last few years. From you sort of have to be on social media, I think, as an author, it's kind of expected. And it's been really great, like for developing relationships and sort of meeting authors, meeting readers, you know, that's been good, even though I do mainly post pictures of cats and currently a hedgehog. No, it's really nice, and especially during lockdown, you know, sort of trapped in your own home. But I think the downside is it's for me, it's made it a lot harder to do that sort of serious concentration that writing requires. So when I was writing the first book, I didn't really have this. I was on Facebook, but it wasn't really a big part of my life at all. And also when writing was a hobby, it was somehow easier to focus, whereas now it's more of a job.
Yes.
It's much more difficult. So when I feel myself kind of going down that distractible sort of rabbit hole, checking emails, checking Twitter, checking Facebook, I know I need to sort of get control of myself, which I sometimes just have to make myself, you know, not do any of that stuff between certain hours of the day. Or I just do my half hour
sort of nice.
And literally just do sprints. So sort of sprints of half an hour, I absolutely just only think about writing.
Roz has just held, for those of you listening, she's just held up, what are they called, an hourglass?
Yeah, it's like an egg timer, but it's half hour one.
Yeah. That's a bit like the Pomodoro technique, isn't it?
Very much, yeah, yeah. It is exactly the Pomodoro technique. It's just that the tomato-y things tick.
Oh, and it's annoying.
Yeah. So this is like a lovely glass, kind of attractive, big egg timer thing.
Yeah.
That does half an hour, and I do sprints of that, and that really helps me.
No, that's another brilliant tip. So do you use it for when you're on social media or when you're writing? Sorry.
When I'm writing. So yeah. I'll basically do a half hour solid sprint. And then the other thing that I managed to do in the early days of my writing was knacker my knees through spending far too much time sitting down with my legs tucked under me, which is how I like to sit.
Yeah.
And so now after my half hour, I'll get up and wander around a bit and sort of, I always think I should get up and do some yoga or something, but that doesn't really happen. But I just at least get up and walk around and, you know, do something to stop my legs sort of seizing up.
It's
really easy when you're writing to be kind of hunched over your laptop or, you know, with your legs somewhere that's not good. So, yeah. So that I do half hour sprints and then wander around a bit. And you can't do that. Well, I can't do that many of those really solid, solid concentration sprints before, you know, I need a proper break. But yeah, that really helps.
No. And again, I think that's a great tip. And my book coach, she does headstands.
Oh, God. Puts me to shame, wander around the room a bit.
But there's also that they reckon if you don't take a break every 90 minutes, your body goes into fight or flight.
Right.
So you are triggering stress by not moving. So that's really good. I like that tip. So moving on, segueing in into chapter 3, which is understanding what causes you to think. So often, when I'm working with clients, when we sink, it's often a series of triggers. So I was working, for example, with a guy this morning, and there'd been an incident at work, and it wasn't just one thing that had triggered him, it was three things. And that had caused him to have the reaction he had, but then sink for a bit. Yeah. So, and then what we do is then I listen to the language and we track back and we go back to the childhood events, because all we're done, so these triggers, they're just related to childhood experiences, and then we're having them away. So thinking about, I suppose, I guess, what causes you to sink, and also stress and that type of thing, what either positive or negative childhood experiences have influenced your personality for the better? Or it could be in a limiting way, whatever you want to share.
So the one I thought of when I just read through these questions, the one that struck me that was a thing that sort of was positive in the long run was something that happened when I was five, when it was my second day at a brand new school. And although it probably seems really bizarre to younger people, but when I was five, the sort of Jurassic period, it was normal to let a five-year-old walk home from school on her own.
Yes.
And, yeah, was it the same with
you? Yeah, and, four and a half for walk to school.
Yeah, well, it was only because we'd moved house that it was, you know, that I was five and not four and a half. My old school was at my old house. So it was the new school. And so I'd been told, you know, this is the way you walk home. But the new school, they chucked us out of a different exit than the one that I'd come in at. So although I knew the way home from the other place, I got really confused. And I went wandering off, and I knew I was supposed to go left, then left. It wasn't very far. But I ended up sort of on the main road. And I got a bit scared, obviously. But what I did was I walked up to a stranger and a woman, as it was. But I would have asked a man as well, and just said, oh, do you know where? And then said my address, where that is. And, of course, she took me home. And it was scary, but I thought it was a nice thing to happen, because it sort of taught me that it's good to ask for help, and to trust people, and that actually most strangers are probably not, you know, gonna take you off and murder you. And you know, I got home and I was absolutely fine, and I think I have sort of hung on to that. I mean, I tend to think it's not a bad thing to ask for help, and it's not a bad thing to assume that most people are decent.
I agree entirely. And, you know, from a personal development perspective, because I've only just listened to 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm a bit of a bugger when it comes to, here's a popular book, and I'll go, well, I'm not reading it then. Which is ridiculous. I've always been a bit like that. Don't follow a trend, just create your own. And anyway, so I got around to listening to it, and he was talking about, you know, interdependence. And so I've always felt proud that I was independent, but of course we need to be interdependent as well, don't we, if we're going to really flourish. And so I think it's brilliant that you learn that lesson so early on, that you are prepared to ask for help. Because again, you know, from a leadership perspective, those leaders that aren't able to ask for help, it's when they sink, because they're too busy trying to do everything themselves, and they're either being perfectionists or overly controlling. They think only they can do the job the right way. So no, I think that's a brilliant example. Cool. So we're going to move on to chapter 5, which is all about navigating towards destination joy. And the reason we navigate towards destination joy is that when we're experiencing imposter syndrome, which then can drive on, imposter syndrome can help our performance, studies are showing that, but it's when we overdo it, you know, when we're on that track of always proving, always pushing, that it can then lead to stress and workaholism. Wore the t-shirt. So what we're aiming towards, so if that's how it's been, we're also, one of the antidotes is to identify, actually, what do I want instead? What's my idea of destination joy? So thinking about the next 3 to 5 years, where are you heading?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think, you know, interesting question, because I was thinking about this earlier. I was thinking there are things that I really want in my writing career, but that I've almost decided not to have them in my head as specific goals.
Yeah.
Because so many of them are so much outside my control. Because I have in the past got quite hung up on wanting to achieve things. And I'm at the point now where, you know, I would absolutely love it if one of my books was made into a TV series, for example. I mean, yeah. One of them was optioned, but it didn't come to anything. Or I'd love, you know, to be a massive bestseller or to sell in 30 different countries or all these things. But I've realised that to sort of set that as a goal is counterproductive for me, because I really, really can't control it. Yeah. I can only write the best books that I possibly can. And then so much of that other stuff is not within my control. It's random, you know, when it comes out, whether it hits the right moment or not, how much of a push it gets, all sorts of, you know, ITV didn't do the series partly because they just bought one that was too similar, you know, things like that you really can't control, and you can get yourself so hung up on that. So those sort of things I tend not to have as goals, and I tend not to kind of think about them too much, really. But then there is other stuff that I can control, like I've just mentioned before, sort of considering a move to Cornwall, and you know, that's something I can control, and I can sort of visualize the, you know, kind of house and by near the sea, walking on the coast path, that sort of thing. And that works for me because it's something that I feel like I can make happen. But I've kind of also things like, you know, reviews and what people think about your book. You know, I used to get really upset by 1-star reviews at the beginning. And I'd read them, which is not a good idea. And now I've realised that it's virtually impossible not to get upset if you get a really awful review in a newspaper or something, because it's a horrible thing to happen. But that's never happened to me. I've only had horrible reviews from people on Amazon, and I don't know what's going on in their life. So why get upset about it? Why allow them that power? And I did used to, at the very beginning, I used to get upset by that, but I don't anymore. So that's another thing that's not, I can't control that. You can't ever write a book that gets no 1-star reviews, unless it gets very few reviews. So there are those two different sort of types of thing that I have different types of goals for, I suppose, if that makes sense.
But again, you've just given a really good tip. I knew you'd be full of nuggets, genius. and it's all to do with locus of control, isn't it? You know, we can stress ourselves out by wishing for things that we can't control. And whereas if we focus on, just as you've said, stuff that is within our power and control.
And that, you know, the whole sort of, you know, there's this thing that if you sort of visualize something you want enough, it will happen. Well, obviously, you, without doing all the other things that you've talked about in your book, it probably won't. I know the research suggests that if you visualize that you have this wonderful life, then part of your brain shuts down and says, we've already got it, there's no point in doing anything. The whole kind of like stuff will manifest for you. I haven't found that to work, and I know it doesn't work. So, you know, I do, it's not that I give up on being, you know, a sort of a bestseller or whatever, in that I still try and set myself kind of targets of things I can achieve, like working a certain number of hours a day or whatever. But I do try to let go of that kind of end result goal.
That I
can't control, and I can visualize that as much as I want, but it's really not going to make very much difference to whether it happens or not, unfortunately.
No, you're absolutely right. And I include some research in my book about that. They measured a drop in, I can never say it, systolic pressure. So what you're saying is backed by science, that, you know, visualizing the outcome all the time. You've got to visualize the steps.
Yeah, yeah.
Leading towards.
Get off your arse and do it.
Yeah, do something. Yeah, exactly. I was listening to, what's he called? Frankie Dettori.
Oh, yeah.
Today on Virgin, and he's released a book.
Right.
And I hadn't realised he'd suffered quite deep trauma because his plane had crashed and he nearly died a couple of times. And I was thinking, oh, I know a technique that works very well with trauma and gets rid of it. And I do have in my mind that I would like to help a famous person one day. Mm-hmm. And so this might be might contradict what we've just been talking about. I also have the belief you have to be in it to win it, don't you? So you have to take actions. So I left a really random message for him today on on Instagram. And I just thought, well, whatever, you know, you can ignore it or you can take me up on my offer. But, you know, unless we try and we take those steps, just as you've been saying, towards the thing that we want, how are we going to ever achieve that?
Yeah, you didn't just visualise you interviewing him, did you? You actually did something about it.
Well, it was literally a 30-second message. Excuse me.
Well, you
but
never anyway, know, do you?
No. But but again, letting go of the outcome. I just think, whatever, what'll be, will be.
Yeah, you can't control that, definitely.
No, exactly. Anyway, so... So I'm going to move on to chapter 9, which is about learning to handle rough seas. So rough seas are our emotions. And it was interesting, again, had a gentleman this morning and he said, oh, I saw the tissue box and I was worried I was going to cry. And I said, look, hey, I have seen many grown men cry. And, you know, it's kind of a commodity for me that sometimes when we touch on past stuff that's still influencing present day, that it can provoke tears. But, you know, I am completely used to it. And it's, you know, it's, as I say, it's a commodity. Mm. And I was sharing with you earlier that my dad died, it was a week ago today, actually. And one of the ways in which we, my sister and I, processed our emotions, so we didn't use any fancy techniques, didn't use Havening, EFT, didn't journal, but the way that we handled our rough seas, so our rough seas were our emotions. And I think the difficult thing, you know, with cancer is you watch, you almost do your grieving in front of the person. Well, not physically in front of the person. That's what we were trying to avoid, is to be upset in front of dad. We wanted to handle those rough seas so that we could be strong for him. And the way that we handled the rough seas, we literally walked up and down Morecambe Prom, and we used to say, it was like passing a baton. We'd take it in turns to cry. Some days I was strong, sometimes my sister was strong. And we would empty our, we called it empty, I need to empty my tear buckets, you know, and we would release that stuff and then we could be strong for dad. So that's an example of how, you know, I've learned to handle rough seas during grief. So how do you manage your state of mind and how do you handle your, because life does throw us waves, doesn't it, now and then?
Yeah, I mean, I agree really with the whole thing about letting yourself feel it, because, you know, there's some sort of ideas about, oh, you know, almost like you've got to be positive the whole time, think positively, be cheerful or whatever. And, you know, that I don't think that's sense, a bit like trying not to think of that white bear, isn't it? You know, the more you tell yourself to be cheerful, you're then monitoring yourself, am I cheerful, am I cheerful? And you actually end up being less, you know, less happy than if you allow yourself to be genuine in your emotions. So I think for something genuinely awful like you, I just let myself feel it, let myself feel awful. But for things where I think a change of attitude, you know, like something like your dad dying is genuinely terrible, but something like getting a one-star review is not. So for things like that, I do try and kind of reframe stuff and change, you know, change my attitude to things. Or, you know, if I'm having a day where I think I can't write another book, I will try and talk to myself and tell myself I've written four and I can write a fifth. And that kind of just, you know, basic stuff. Other times I'll do some, you know, if I'm just feeling really down about things. I mean, the state of the world at the moment, it's easy to focus on terrible stuff, isn't it? You can get sucked into it. There's so much if you want to focus on bad things, which I do let myself sometimes. And I also do think sometimes you have to get yourself angry so that you can do stuff. You know, I'm not averse to going on a march and writing to MPs and that sort of thing. But you know, if I need to just get rid of all that and get on with some work, then I will sort of try and just talk myself out of it and maybe again like go for a walk or something, or do some exercise, or dance around the kitchen, play with the dogs or the cats, and you know, just make myself cheer up.
No, so there's a real well, there's a few things there. One, have you come across the term toxic positivity? That was bandied around on social media quite a bit.
Right. I don't know if I have, but I know exactly what that would mean. Yes.
Yeah. I call it a bit like Rod. Do you remember the characters Rod, Jane, and Freddie? Ah, everything is okay. And really, it's not.
Just crying themselves to sleep every night.
So that's really unhealthy, is to just pretend like everything's okay, because then it can bite you on the bum in, you know, the most unexpected way, or we can explode or implode, whichever way. Or, you know, again, just listening to a client the other day talking about how he was aware of someone was triggered emotionally, and then all of a sudden they started having heart problems. Do you know what I mean? So mind influencing body. But also when I listen to you, there's a strong theme of doing something. So, you know, dancing, or, you know, allowing yourself to feel, which I'll be honest, that's a new concept for me over the last, I would say, 5 years or so. And I think I probably used to do the toxic positivity thing. Everything's okay. When in reality, and I think what it brought, you know, it was brought home when I watched that Daft movie, you know, about emotions.
I haven't seen it, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
Where the little girl has got all the different emotions in her head. Mm. And you think, yeah, joy has competition.
Yeah.
What do you mean? We can't be that all the time, can we? Because there's competition for our emotions. And I think it helps us experience the light and shade of life, doesn't it?
Yeah. You can't be happy all the time. It's just not possible.
Yeah, but it's cool also that listening to your focus of attention is important, isn't it? Where we choose, so, you know, consciously choosing to actually, I am going to look at the news and I am going to get angry about it because that will provoke action, or actually, I'm going to choose to not look at, I didn't look at the news during COVID very much because I didn't want to fill my head with nonsense. It wasn't nonsense, but too much negativity.
There wasn't much we could do about any of it, really, was there? I mean, and clicking like on someone's Facebook post is not action, so it's like there wasn't much point in a way in getting sucked down into it. So similar. It was hard at the beginning, wasn't it? I mean, it was impossible not to sort of follow what was going on and be distracted by it. But once it's been going on a while, I think you have to. I was glad I had a book deadline, actually. It sort of forced me to just get on with life, even if it did feel like everything was falling apart around me. I was like, well, I've just got to write this book, actually.
So we're going to bring things to a close. Another quick round, although our quick fire rounds aren't turning into quick fire rounds, are they? So what's the worst piece of advice you've heard being given?
I think it's this kind of jump and the parachute will appear type advice.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we both obviously did the coaching and NLP, and most of that is really sensible, but there does seem to be this like lunatic fringe of that. Well, you know, it's like, no, sorry, jump and the parachute won't necessarily appear unless you put a parachute on your back and learn how to use it.
Yeah.
It's like, I suppose it's tied up with that whole visualization sort of the secret and that kind of thing, that, you know, if you imagine millions of pounds, they will suddenly manifest themselves and all that sort of thing. I think it's great to, you know, to work hard for what you want in life, et cetera, but to think that if you just kind of do mad things, you'll be okay, it doesn't always
I love it. So when you think about success, who springs to mind?
Well, the person that springs to mind, I know she's a slightly controversial figure at the moment, unfortunately, but the person that springs to mind to me is J.K. Rowling, because I love that whole, moving from a sort of awful situation with domestic violence and poverty, et cetera, writing the book in the cafe and to mega success. It's a nice story. I haven't actually read the Harry Potter books at all. I don't know a huge amount about her, but that was kind of what sprung to mind.
Yeah, nice. I like it. So to bring things to a conclusion, what would you say is your biggest insider secret that you would like to share with people, or nugget of advice, or favorite phrase or saying?
I think we've covered most of it, really. I mean, it's funny when you said my favorite saying came into my mind, which is completely irrelevant, which is never try to outstubborn a cat. And I don't even know where that came from. just popped into my head, that's your favorite saying. Possibly it is. But I think we've kind of covered most of the stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's been loads of nuggets as we've gone along, so that's cool. And is there anything else you want listeners to know about? So your book titles, for example, or how can people connect, find out more about you? What would you like to share?
So I'm Twitter's a good place to find me, especially if you do like pictures of animals. And I'm at Roz Watkins.
Yeah.
And my first book that Estelle mentioned at the beginning, The Devil's Dice, that's the first in a series. So there's a paperback of that here, actually, I can just show as well.
Lovely.
So, I'd love you to buy my books, obviously. Do connect on Twitter. Yeah, that's usually the best place to find me, there when I shouldn't be, when I should be working.
Nice. And you say you're up to book number 5. So you've got book number 4 coming out hopefully next year, did you say?
Yeah, that's nearly finished. We've had 2 rounds of edits and we're just sort of hopefully near to finalising that. And I'm just sort of, My main editor's been off on maternity leave and she's just come back. So she's reading that at the moment and also reading a pitch for book 5. So at the moment, just waiting to hear back from her on both of those. And then it's full steam ahead with book 5, hopefully.
Yay.
Which sounds a bit scary.
Yeah, it is 5 books. That's amazing. Well, you know, I can talk to hours for you. You're so interesting. You've got such an amazing mind and just really on a pedestal for me. I'm so impressed with everything that you've done. No, seriously, genuinely. It seems like whatever you do, you turn your hand to, you do a brilliant job of. And I'll always be really grateful for you kicking me up the rear and saying, get yourself a proper publishing deal. So I really appreciate it, and thank you for endorsing the book.
Oh, I loved it. It was great.
No, oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Leader Insider Secrets. You can help this podcast grow by leaving an honest review. Also, if you want to get future episodes, remember to hit subscribe. Finally, if you're interested in working with me, you can book a free 30-minute discovery session, or you can connect and access other resources in the link below. I'm Estelle Reed at B.Company, executive coach, trainer, and author. This has been Leader Insider Secrets.